On April 23rd, 2006, 6-year-old Gareth went to play with his 8-year-old next-door neighbor, Jacob. When Gareth arrived, he knocked on the door and didn't hear anyone. The curious kid looked through the basement window and saw a person laying on the floor covered in blood. He went to tell his mom what he saw. The mom, of course, not believing at first, went next door only to find her son was in fact telling the truth. She called police, and when they entered the home, they found the bodies of Deborah, Mark, and Jacob Richardson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Crime, a true crime podcast hosted by me, Justice, a doctor of forensic psychology.
And me, Rebecca, a criminologist.
You won't find clickbait titles, selfie thumbnails, or spooky music to set the mood here. But what you will find is ethical true crime with extra focus on empathy, accuracy, and a viewpoint from professionals.
So grab your coffee and let's get started.
Trigger warning. This is a pretty gruesome case and involves many triggering topics like drugs, drinking, suicide, grooming, and the death of a child. I also do want to warn you, we will be using direct quotes from the offenders that may have some offensive terms in them. I will warn you before I say them, but please proceed this episode with caution. For this case, we are going to Medicine Hat, Alberta, which is in Canada. In 2003, Mark and Deb Richardson moved their family to Medicine Hat, Alberta. This came as a very welcomed change as Mark just received a hefty job promotion that the couple had been waiting for. Mark and Deb arrived in the small city and immediately enrolled their children, Jasmine 10 and Jacob 7, in Catholic school. The Richardsons were described as an ordinary family full of love and life. Mark would take Jasmine out on dad and daughter dates, and Deb would do the same with Jacob. The parents believed in quality time and would try to ensure that their children knew that they had parents that loved them. While most of the family was adjusting, Jasmine was starting to rebel quite a bit. She had a really hard time adjusting to this move. She had also begun to question the religion, and she started believing in the Wiccan practice. Her mother, Deb, was very spiritual and was even a Reiki master and very big into meditation, had tarot cards, was really kind of into that lifestyle. And this had really influenced Jasmine. Jasmine would eventually get in trouble for school for drawing a pentagram on her hand and talking about tarot cards and stuff like that. And she would start talking back to her teachers who would discuss religion. So she's already starting to rebel a little bit. And then in summer of 2005, Jasmine, who's 11 years old at this time, was starting to gain popularity in the goth crowd. She was wearing dark eyeliner, all black clothes, chokers, short skirts, shirts with obscene words on them, and was completely see-through. The Richardsons felt like that they were losing their daughter, but also expected this to only be a phase, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. At the start of her 7th grade year, Jasmine was described as incredibly changed, or even her guidance counselor was noticing a big difference in her persona. The once very academically gifted student and swim team member was now completely unrecognizable. It was around this time that Jasmine started making social media profiles and talking to older peers around the ages of 19 and 20. Some of these males she considered very close friends, and she would hang out at the mall, and her group of friends got larger and larger. Jasmine had started dating a 16-year-old in which she brought home to her parents, and they were trying really hard to be supportive, and they were asking a lot of questions and just trying to get to know him. But Jasmine was embarrassed by this exchange. She didn't want her parents really talking to the 16-year-old again, and the parents had also determined that they really were not comfortable with a 12-year-old dating a 16-year-old.
12 and 16, it's not only weird because those are two children who are in wildly different developmental stages. Part of what may have made her parents uncomfortable is that the age of consent in Canada is 16 years old, which Jasmine was obviously not even close to.
Yeah, it's always so difficult because when you think of like young teenagers, 12 is so different from 14, and mm-hmm. 14 is so different from 16. And then you think about 12 to 16, and then they're just different worlds of development.
Yeah, to me, like a 16-year-old, that's a, you know, an older teenager, but a 12-year-old, that's a child, like a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Puberty hasn't even hit at that point. Like, mm-hmm. you're a child. So right now, I just want to mention, it is at this time, late 2005, that Jasmine really started to open up on her social media profiles. She had many monikers across many sites. Some of these names included X underscore killer underscore kitty underscore X, or X underscore madness underscore X, and the infamous Runaway Devil.
Oh, those are interesting usernames. What kind of stuff was she saying online?
So this is where it gets a little interesting. Jasmine had started to lie about her age on all the sites she was on. She would say she was 15 on some and 16 on others. And of course, each website had its own use. So on mindviz.com, which was mostly like a teen chat room, hangout type site, she didn't list her age on there, but she was talking to a lot of people in the age range between 17 and 19. So it was just kind of assumed by everyone that that's what her age was. She did say that she was bisexual and that she posted a photo of her holding what looks to be a real gun, but I believe it was fake when I was researching this case. Jasmine created an account on vampirefreaks.com where she listed her age as 15. And this is where she would post very inappropriate pictures, very seductive, very risky. She would not only do like risky poses, but she would also pose with knives and guns and like she was drinking blood and just kind of dark stuff, especially for a 12-year-old. Now, there's also an account on Zorpa or Zorpia, which is another social media site. I believe it was a Canadian website.
Okay.
But she listed herself there as 15 as well. She had a MySpace page where she claimed she was 16 and would list her interests as serial killers, criminal psych, blood, moonlight, human anatomy, and kinky shit.
I'm sorry. Kinky shit? This is a 12-year-old.
Well, yes. However, unless someone was directly in her greater family, no one actually knew Jasmine's age. She was very far developed physically at the age of 12. It had actually started to make her very self-conscious, and her mom tried to buy her clothes and make her feel more confident, but Jasmine kind of declined that and wanted to stick with what she felt better in. Neighbors would eventually tell police that they thought she was way older because of her body structure and heavy makeup. Even her neighbors were not sure. Everyone that was talking to police all thought she was between like 15 and 17. Jeez. Not a single person outside of the family said she was close to 12. I do just want to like briefly just go over too that it is the hormones that start to sexualize them so early, especially because now they're gaining, you know, the child is gaining breasts and their hips and they're starting to feel more in their own body, which is of course going to make them have more sexual thoughts at a right. much higher rate. So it definitely has to do with hormones. But yes, I did say that she was hanging out with a 23-year-old. Jeremy was 23 years old, and he was pretty well known in the goth crowd. He had come to the scene a few years earlier and made friends who seemed to understand his troubles and abusive background. Jeremy was teased from the start of his schooling years, as young as 6 years old, and he was made fun of for wearing dirty clothes, not being as developed as the rest of the class. They would call him stinky instead of stanky, and just, they were pretty bad to him. He would get into fights a lot at school, and by high school, Jeremy was placed in classes where other students had learning difficulties, and he dropped out during the 10th grade.
Ooh. Well, first of all, listening to these podcasts about this case, I listened to a few where they made fun of his name.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of fucked up that was part of like the bullying that happened to him as a child.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, yeah. You mentioned that he had an abusive past. Was he the abusive one, or was he abused?
According to him and his mother, Jeremy was heavily abused. His father was very physically abusive, and his mom had an alcohol problem. After his parents divorced, he had two subsequent stepfathers that also physically, emotionally, and mentally abused Jeremy and step-siblings or siblings. Jeremy's mom testified that one of her partners had thrown Jeremy into a freezer, injuring his head, and grabbed Jeremy by the neck and gave him cuts to his face and then pounded him in the back of the head.
Jesus Christ.
Jeremy also had told the courts that his second stepfather would tie all of the children to a chair and force them to watch their sibling being like heavily beaten to the point of like unconsciousness.
What the fuck?
Jeremy did retaliate against his latest stepfather, as the stepfather was choking Jeremy's mom, and Jeremy started chasing him around with a lead pipe and broke his arm, saying to never hurt his mom again.
Okay, so Jeremy definitely has a troubled past. I'm sure that dropping out of school at such an important developmental stage affected his social life and his relationships as well. And I know that we mentioned, like, obviously there's something that's causing him to want to hang out with younger people or to be comfortable hanging out with younger people. Like, this isn't a common age gap where they know each other from school, or something's going on.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely, he really couldn't hang out with his peers. You know, as Jeremy grew older, he felt more and more alienated from his peers. They were going to college. They were getting in serious relationships. You know, they were kind of becoming adults, and he just didn't have the capacity to do that. And so he kind of stayed in the group of goths, where the kids stayed the same age but he didn't, kind of deal, because it felt like he continuously understood them. He was always in that mindset. He did have a couple friends that were closer to his age but still a little younger, but they were of like mind. They had very similar backgrounds, similar outlooks, you know, dropouts, just very similar in that kind of way. So in early 2006, Jasmine, who was hanging out at the mall with the goth friends, one of her friends had introduced Jeremy at a mall meetup, and it was just kind of like a, hey, he's cute, what's his name, and then nothing too much after that. But then they went to a punk rock show a little while later, and that's when they began to know each other. They were following each other on social media, and they were writing love songs and poems to each other. I just want to read you like a couple of them, because it's very interesting to me. So March 2nd of 2006. So this is from Jeremy to Jasmine, saying, so, yeah, do you truly feel that you have fallen in love with me? I really want to know. If so, all you have to do is tell me. You mean so much to me. I don't want anything to ruin what we have, so please tell me everything truthfully. Are you going to be able to go to the punk shows on the 9th next week at Scouts Hall, and the 7th not next week, the one after? It's at the Moose, yet I don't know why. Well, I miss you lots. Hope to hear from you soon. XOXO, later, beautiful, love. So after that message, Jasmine had responded, well, you see, I fucking love you. Now, Jeremy, the budding death metal lyricist, also emailed Jasmine a song he wrote titled Till Death We Part, saying, you're the blood that flows through my veins. You're the sun breaking through the cloud when it rains. My love is for you forever. As we die here together, we'll be together forever till death do we part. He then signed off by saying, hope you enjoy, love you tons, later, cuddle bunny. So Jasmine responded to that email with, haha, yeah, you make me feel so loved, hearts. Yes, I do love you, you're wonderful, kiss kiss. Then we have another email chain that's from Jeremy that says, God, I can't get over not seeing or talking to you. I yearn to hear your soft, subtle voice and long to be held in your arms wherever that might be. I don't care, but just to share time we have together with you are to die for. And there is not anything that could ever replace the way you make me feel. Hearts, I miss you. I love you, and I wish that we could just go somewhere and we could just be alone together for a little while, or as long as you would like. I think tonight I'm going to write another song for you. Won't that be fun? Especially seeing as you shall not read it or hear it till I see you next. Teehee, Raffle. Well, I guess I should go something, but I hope to hear from you mega sooner than later. Talk to you later, Cuddle Bunny. Rar, rar.
The rar just took me straight back to middle school.
Yeah, they started a lot of chains and ended a lot of chains with rar. So as you can tell, there is definitely a lot of love bombing from both of them.
Oh, yeah.
So while I know that the audience's jaw is on the floor right now, rightfully so, with the idea of a 23-year-old and a 12-year-old telling each other that I love you, we do have to take a slight step back and just remember that Jeremy didn't actually know Jasmine's age. She hung out with again, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. And it wasn't until a few weeks later that Jasmine was getting concerned that he might know and would stop dating her. So she had one of her friends approach him and was like, hey, do you know how old Jasmine is? And he said 17. So the friend's like, okay, all right, yeah, cool. Like pretending that she didn't know either. Then a couple weeks later, he was on her profile and noticed it said 15.
Okay. I'm sure during their relationship, if you can call it that, yeah, her parents were pretty unhappy.
Well, after dating the 16-year-old and their disapproval of the situation, Jasmine just figured she would just keep this one little secret. So she would ask to go to the mall to see her friends, and he would just happen to be there. Now, of course, you and I both know, parents find out. And they found out. They grounded Jasmine basically until the end of the century. She could only go to school and to home, but they did allow her her computer because they did not know at first what she was doing, because she needed it for school. So she would message Jeremy and her friends about her desire to kill her parents because she wanted to be free of her parents. She said that they were so unfair and so controlling, and they wouldn't let her be herself or date who she wanted. The parents had suggested family therapy to try and get through to Jasmine, and she agreed. The parents thought it was working well, and Jasmine's behavior had improved, so they gave her permission to go to a rock concert. But the stipulation was that the parents needed to chaperone. Jasmine was not too excited about that, but she figured she could just lose them in the crowd and she could do what she wanted. So, like an idiot, at this concert, Jasmine snuck out to meet Jeremy. And then one of Jasmine's friends was there, and she was supposed to go with the friend to like go across the street or whatever. But she ditched the friend and went behind an alley and started making out with Jeremy. Furious, of course. Yeah. So Jeremy just books it, and it was a very awkward, silent ride home. So they took away her computer. They took away her, like, right to do anything. She wasn't allowed. She was allowed to go to school and come right home. She wasn't allowed to really see friends. She wasn't allowed to use the phone at the house. There's actually a story where, I guess, Jeremy accidentally called the house. And, like, that got her in even more trouble because they thought that she was sneaking out, which... rightfully so, because we're going to learn a little bit more about that.
This is so difficult because, you know, teenagers.
Yeah.
I can see where, you know, in Jasmine's eyes, her parents are controlling her and they're ruining her life. They're keeping her from this 23-year-old who she thinks is, you know, her one true love. But as a mother, I cannot physically imagine stumbling upon my 12-year-old daughter making out with an adult man. And if she was sneaking around their rules anyways, like, her parents probably felt pretty helpless. Like, punishing her is probably not going to stop her.
Right, exactly. I mean, when you think of, like, I remember being a teenager. I was 14, 15, dating, like, a 16, 17-year-old. And my mom was furious.
Yeah, I mean, looking at, you know, now that we've already aged ourselves and said how old we are. But looking back now... Oh, yeah, I'd be pissed too.
So Jasmine became very vocal about her hatred from her parents. She told all of her friends how she wanted to kill them. She would tell teachers and guidance counselors that she wanted to be a foster child because she hated her parents. They had too many rules. She was still sneaking off when she could try and see Jeremy, but it was not working because her mom would catch her literally every single time. She was not quiet. She was not smart. And, like, looking back, I remember, like, having such a good idea to, like, sneak out of the house. And my mom, she knew what I was doing before I had even concocted the plan. So, I mean, I'm not saying I feel for Jasmine, but I definitely remember being in that mindset, you know? Mm-hmm. Jasmine was getting caught sneaking out, and... her parents had approved a couple of her friends because they wanted her to be a teenager. They didn't want her to feel so alienated. So they allowed a few of her friends. Now they were 15. They were like, her friends were like 15. I think both of them were. So it was still a little older, but at least they're like, it's 15-year-old girls. Like,
yeah,
not too bad. So while hanging out with the parents, the friends her parents approved of, she asked to borrow one of their phones and called Jeremy stating, I can't stand it anymore. They have to die. I need you to do this for me. Now, the friends heard this and they were like very creeped out by this. So they just kind of walked away and just were like, I didn't hear that. I don't, that's weird. Now, Jeremy's friends had also overheard conversations where Jasmine would say things like, so will you kill them for me? And he would respond, I don't know, babe, I'll think about it.
Okay.
Ironically, one of the friends that overheard this conversation was later asked by Jeremy if he would help kill Jasmine's parents. He thought it was off, but was kind of nervous that he was serious, but also was like, Jeremy's too nice of a guy. Because at this point, all of Jeremy's friends just say that he's a super nice guy, would do anything for you. He's not all there, but
okay,
would do anything for you. So at this point, like, they're just like, it's a like really weird thing to ask, but like he doesn't mean it. Like, he's not capable of that. Jeremy then was like, please, like, will you help me? I don't want to do it alone and I need help. And his friend told him, absolutely not. And like, if you're thinking about doing it, don't do it. Jasmine would tell her friends that she was planning to kill her parents to be with the love of her life. And she would also tell her friends about her older boyfriend who was going to help her. And of course, none of her friends listened.
I wouldn't ever place blame in these situations on someone who didn't commit the murder, but it really seems like kind of a huge tragedy could have been avoided if any of these people who were literally told what was going to happen had taken it seriously, or maybe mentioned what they'd heard to someone, or just got something.
I know it's so hard because, like, during the time, you don't think it's happened. You're like, yeah, okay, sure, whatever, like, the amount of times I'm like, oh my god, I could totally kill my mom. Like, how could she not be let me be with this totally gorgeous 16-year-old boy when I'm 14? How right. could she not let that happen? Like, ugh, I could just kill her. Or, ugh, my brother's so annoying, I could totally kill him. We use that hyperbole in the English language a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So everyone that was probably at that lunch table had all mentioned that they were going to kill their brothers or sisters or parents at one point or another. So it's, yeah. like, so hard because you don't think it's going to be true. Like, no, like, she's too nice and he's too nice. They would never do that. Like, come on. Well, on April 22nd of 2006, Jeremy watched a movie called Natural Born Killers, which is about a pair of traumatized individuals who go on a killing spree, leaving everyone for dead except for one person so that one person could tell the story and the pair could become infamous. Jeremy later refers to this movie as the greatest love story of all time. Now, it is nighttime and Jeremy had been drinking. He had done coke. He had been smoking pot. There was rumor, but no, like, official determination that he was also on LSD. So he definitely had a lot of drugs in him.
Okay.
So he watches this movie. He's very inspired because he's wondering how he was going to kill Jasmine's parents. He shows up to the house and he sneaks in through a basement window. Now, Deb had heard commotion and she assumed Jasmine was trying to sneak out yet again. So she went down to the basement and met with a masked man who started stabbing her. Deb started screaming horrifically, and Mark ran down to the basement, and he also met the masked intruder and fought to his dying breath. The coroner said that he had so many defensive wounds that that man was fighting until he died, truly. Mark's last words were, "Why are you doing this?" And Jeremy replied with, "It's what your daughter wanted." Ugh. In the meantime, Jasmine is upstairs in the hallway, trying and eventually succeeding in killing her baby brother. Deb was stabbed 12 times and Mark was stabbed 24 times, as well as being strangled. Jacob was stabbed 4 times and his throat was slit. After the gruesome murder was committed, Jeremy ran out of the house and drove away. Jasmine, who was still grabbing things, was screaming for his name, but to no avail, no answer. Jasmine then realized that he had gotten in the truck and drove away, so she took a cab to the mutual friend's house that she knew he was going to. It was there that they had partied all night. Now, people at the party were saying that they were all over each other, and they were drinking all night, they were smoking, they were having a great time. Everything seemed fine. They even had sex, which is not surprising at all. It was, from what the research I gathered, this was the first time they had sex was after the crime. which does not surprise me at all, because this is very much a thrill killing.
Yeah.
But they were having a grand old time. So the next morning is when 6-year-old Gareth and his mother discovered the bodies and called police. Investigators walked into the house. They found the parents and they found a sign of a massive struggle. The investigators were looking in the house to figure out what was going on. They walked into the bedroom of Jasmine and they noticed that the light was turned off and blood was smeared on the light switch. They noticed a lot of blood in the hallway and they discovered the body of 8-year-old Jacob Richardson. Now I'm going to warn you, the next part is going to break your heart more than any other fact in any other true crime case in the history of ever. So if you're like extremely empathetic, I just skip 30 seconds. So while investigators were looking, they found a toy lightsaber next to Jacob's body that he used to defend himself against his sister.
I've been doing true crime research for quite some time, and that fact is quite possibly the saddest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's, I don't know what it is for me, but every single time, like, I think of that fact of just this little boy using, like, this innocent little saber, because that's all he knows, because he's super into Star Wars, and, like, in his mind, that's what you use to defend yourself. Like, it just breaks my heart.
That's why it's bad, because it's so innocent.
Exactly. That's just, it's just the innocence of it is just what gets me.
Yeah.
So police had noticed there was a family portrait all over the house, and they noticed that they hadn't found the body of the young girl. Police immediately were looking for her. They were afraid they were going to stumble on her body. When they didn't find her body, they were rushing to issue an Amber Alert because they believed that the killer had abducted her. As the Amber Alert was going out, investigators had started to notice things were a little off. They found her computer and had noticed some of the disturbing social media posts on her computer. The following day, police had gone to her school to see if she showed up, which she obviously didn't. And the counselor gave police her locker information. So when they were going through her locker, they found a drawing of a comic strip that she drew that showed her lighting her family on fire and having fun while doing it. So Jasmine went from potential victim to suspect. Now, they had already believed that she was a suspect. They, like, knew something was off almost right away. But when they found that drawing, they're like, okay, we can't cover for this anymore. Like, clearly something's not right. While Jasmine and Jeremy are partying that Sunday night, because this did happen. So Saturday night, the killings happened. Sunday morning is when they had found the bodies. So Jasmine and Jeremy had been partying nonstop, basically, since it happened. Now, it was Sunday, and they had a friend at the party named Casey that was going to drive another friend to Ledge, Saskatchewan. And Casey had noticed that Jeremy and Jasmine seemed really kind of on edge. They went from being on this like high to like very anxious all of a sudden. So she invited them along for the car ride. Casey also invited another friend as a that was a female. And then there was a third person, or like another person that was invited. This person had a crush on the person she was dropping off. So she assumed she was going to drop off the two of them, and then Jeremy, Jasmine, and then her friend would be on the way back.
Okay.
So the four people, so Casey, her friend, the guy she was dropping off, and the girl with a crush were all in the truck that Casey was driving. And Jeremy and Jasmine were like, hey, we need to lay low, because at this point they had heard like that it was starting to get out of what happened. So they're like, we need to lay low. So Casey thought that they were just running away, because it wouldn't surprise either one of them, they would run away. So she's like, okay. There was no room for them in the truck, so they laid under the bed of the truck, or like laid in the bed of the truck with a bunch of blankets, and then like the hood over it. So while they were riding to Saskatchewan, another friend of Jeremy and Jasmine's named Belinda had gone back to the same party that they were all at. So Jasmine and Jeremy have left. The party's still going on. This girl, Belinda, comes back. She was there all night. She left. She came back. Got into a fight with her boyfriend and she ran out. he chased her and he ran into a car. The person in the car thought that was Jeremy because at this point it is plastered all over the news. This person in the car thought that that was Jeremy and called 911. While that guy wasn't Jeremy, there was a massive connection. And once police showed up, every single person sang like a canary. They all told the police that they were going to Saskatchewan and to let them know like who they were dropping off and where they were going to be. Law enforcement was aware of the truck carrying the teens and they were on a lookout. One officer had been waiting by a gas station that was close to the route that the teens would have had to have taken to get to where they needed to be. He saw them stop and get gas and then had seen that they went to go drop off the friend. And then he's like, they're going to be back. I'm going to wait. So he was still at the gas station. Now, when Casey went to drop off that guy and the girl wasn't allowed because the mom was mad. So the girl ended up going home with them. So it's Casey and her two friends and then Jasmine and Jeremy in the trunk of the car. The police, this officer who's like, they're going to have to stop at this gas station before they get to where they need to go. I'm going to wait here, which kind of smart if you think about it.
Yeah, it is.
So he's sitting there, he's purposely hiding, and in pulls the truck. Now, the officer watched three females go out and go inside. And it was at this time that Casey and friends had learned the truth of Jasmine and Jeremy because it was all over the newspaper. They had a TV in the gas station and it was literally on like the reporting of like Jasmine and Jeremy wanted, you know, for the murders. So they freaked out. They bought a newspaper. They went to the truck and they're like, what the fuck is this? What is going on? So their first reaction was Jeremy was like, oh, babe, you don't look anything like that. Like, they use such a bad picture to, like, show who you are. And, like, they're laughing about it. And then they tell Casey everything. So she gets in the car. They drive, like, a mile or two down the road. I forget how far it was. And they pull into a parking lot. And it's a parking lot of a school. And she's like, we need to figure something out. What the fuck? Like, what the fuck? As they're, like, arguing on what to do, the police showed up. And they open the back of the truck and they see a pile of blankets, but then they see the blankets are moving and they lifted up the blankets and they found Jeremy and Jasmine, and Jasmine had her pants and panties down. Pull them back up. All five of them were arrested, but this was a very, very small town, so they literally only had, like, one holding cell. So they had to, like, put one person in the holding cell, one person, like, interrogation, and they had to use cop cars to keep, like, everyone separated.
Jesus.
Now, they end up being charged. They confessed. So Jeremy confessed to, like, multiple people. Jeremy told, like, everybody. But then when going to trial, he went as not guilty. He pled as not guilty. Which, okay. Jasmine was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, which she was found guilty of. And because of the young age, she did serve 10 years, and she now has a different identity and kind of lives a different life. Jeremy was given 3 life sentences, which he serves concurrently, which is basically he serves 25 years, and then as opposed to like 75.
Wow. Firstly, I want to mention how kind of like horrific it is that they just got to party after committing such a brutal attack. You know, they're... Mm-hmm. Engaging in sexual activity. I'm sure their endorphins are high, whatever, but it's fucked.
Yeah.
Also, I'm sure our listeners are currently freaking out that Jasmine was released after only serving 10 years, but I just want everyone to keep in mind that this case doesn't take place in the United States. Other countries have much stricter regulations when it comes to protecting juvenile offenders. It's really difficult, you know, for me, and I don't know about you, Justice, but for me to, like, wrap my mind around as well. Yeah. Yes, he was an adult, but it almost seems unfair that Jeremy's still serving such a long sentence while Jasmine is free. I've said it before, and I think that you mentioned it as well, but their particular relationship and just the sentencing and all of this really reminds me so much of Gypsy Rose Blanchard and Nicholas Godejohn. It's just like striking to me. But when you were doing your research, what did you find sort of regarding the court of public opinion?
Well, I went against my own rule. Actually, I do this every case. So when I'm doing research, I look at social media comments and what people are saying. So I want to think about what questions listeners might have, or what is the general consensus? What is a theme that I'm seeing? Because I might not see something and I might not think of something, but everyone else is, and I want to make sure that I can address that. So I read the comments.
Why would you do that to yourself?
I know. I hate myself for it. It's so hard, such a hard concept to grab. And another thing is that people were saying that she manipulated Jeremy, which honestly is so difficult because I think that they manipulated each other. Now, obviously, a 12-year-old really can't manipulate. Like I just said, like, your brain's not even fully developed, but you can still do things because you want to get what you want. And how do you get what you want? You manipulate things. I don't think she understood what she was doing. And then you have to look inside the psychology of the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of, another thing that was really brought up a lot was people were saying you can't call him a boyfriend. He was a predator. Now, I want to make this abundantly clear. I am not defending Jeremy in what I'm about to say. I am not defending him in any way, shape, or form. I am a professional, and that means I have to look at things objectively, whether we like the outcome or not. It is my job. That being said, Jeremy was very, very clearly behind in his developmental phase. Even looking at his social media, he spoke and he had the emotional intelligence of a teenager. In all of his testimonies, everyone said Jeremy would do anything to help anyone. And to receive love. That is all Jeremy ever wanted, was loved and to be accepted. He wanted love and he wanted to love. And many people took advantage of that kindness. If Jeremy was mentally and intellectually a teenager, it's no surprise that he hung around younger people.
Right.
And he wouldn't see anything wrong with that because in his mind, he's their age.
Mm.
He understands them. This is not some 23-year-old college kid that is just getting away with it because, you know, girls his age won't date him. I mean, yes, girls Jeremy's age wouldn't date him because he was weird and, you know, whatever, and
yeah,
not very accepting. So it's a very different intellectual property. He didn't see anything wrong with hanging out with that age group. He got made fun of and bullied by all the people his own age. Why would you hang out with people that would make fun of you? You wouldn't. You would find a group that doesn't. And that group just happened to be a group of, you know, the local goths that were, you know, between 15 and 19 years old or whatever. And of course, he couldn't keep a job. He was struggling. He was basically homeless. He was just couch surfing. He stayed with his mom for a little bit. But it was very difficult. So it's very difficult if you think about someone who is age-wise and mentally-wise a teenager, you kind of have to put yourself that he's not really preying on Jasmine. Yes, there's the love bombing. Yes, there's like, I want to be with you forever and you're the only one for me. But I think that with where his brain was at, he wasn't doing it to prey on Jasmine. Right. He was doing it because that was how he got love. Now, there were talks about defense lawyers trying to get a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome, as he did have some physical features as well as his development and behavioral issues. He did have diagnosed ADHD. However, the only thing needed to confirm the diagnosis, because he had so many markers, was that his mother needed to admit to drinking while pregnant. While his mom did have an alcohol problem, she vehemently denied drinking while pregnant and said that she did not want to lie to cover for her son, and that she did not drink while pregnant. So it was brought up, but it was denied, and so there was no official diagnosis. Part of fetal alcohol syndrome is being so developmentally behind that you genuinely place yourself with younger people because your brain is that age.
Okay.
Jasmine had also led him on about her age. He believed she was 17 for a decent while, then, read some social media and found that she was 15. And he still should have known that was wrong. But also, if his mind is 17, 18 years old, it's not that predatory.
Right. I mean, and once again, we're in no way excusing Jeremy's actions or his involvement whatsoever.
Nope.
We're more so just reminding everyone that things may not always be exactly as black and white as they appear. So, what can we learn from the crime scene and the way that the Richardson family was murdered? I know we've talked about on our podcast so far, we've talked about drowning and stabbing as the chosen methods of murder before, but we haven't really dealt with a case that involved strangulation.
Yes, so this is a thrill killing, like I mentioned earlier, and is definitely a form of overkill. You can tell there was a relationship between the offender and the victim with the amount of overkill, the fact that it was a stabbing, and the fact that there was strangulation. Both of those things indicate revenge, anger, aggression, sexual tension. Not saying that the offender has sexual tension with the victim, but there is sexual motivation somewhere in there. Whether they're sexually frustrated from not being pleased at home, or whether it is between the victim or the offender, or in this case, he had the sexual urges with Jasmine. So, especially combined together, you can definitely tell that there was a relationship between the two, and there was heavy tension. And again, that overkill is definitely telling me that there was a lot of rage and aggression that was let out. So this probably felt very therapeutic. And now he got to be with the love of his life, and definitely goes to show that it was very angry. I mean, all killings are angry, but this was very personal. This was revenge. This was fuck you. Like, I won. And the strangling too. Strangulation is a big form of control. That's why you find strangulation in a lot of domestic violence cases, is it's a form of control. And so this is basically just Jeremy saying, like, I have control over you and there's nothing you can do. So, I mean, Mark had fought Jeremy to his dying breath. Jeremy had a swollen black eye that was quite literally swollen shut. He had cuts all over him, he had bruises, he had puncture wounds. Like, there was a fight between Mark and Jeremy. And you can definitely tell that just in the crimes, and you can tell with the overkill and the strangulation that this person wanted the control over his life. Another thing that I did want to mention too is that the investigator said that there was one thing in the house that made them realize almost immediately it was someone in the family, because intruders don't turn off lights, and Jasmine's bedroom light was turned off. And the psychology behind that is that when you're in a house, you don't think about lights, right? Like,
Right.
when you're in another person's house or whatever, unless you're instructed to do so, turning off a light is not instinctual. Not knowing where the light switch is, and it's not instinctual. However, a light turned off is very instinctual, because when you live somewhere, what's the first thing you do when you walk out of the room? You just reach for the light switch. You do it every day. You know where that light switch is. So they had known just by that something wasn't right. And of course, the social media posts and then the interviews, as well as confessions later on, confirmed this theory. But right away, they knew that something was definitely very wrong. And I mean, there was so much, like, in their social media posts too, you can just tell that they are just the quirky, awkward, just trying to find themselves, and very dark. And I think that that darkness was just like a way to express themselves, but it definitely took over. And I know a lot of people that were in that community, in the goth community, the second this crime happened, they're like, nope, we don't associate with them. That's not what we do. Like, we want peace. We just want to feel accepted. Like, and essentially, that's all that they both wanted. Now, this case is also considered a feminicide, as well as opposed to parricide. And there was a second offender, so the rules of parricide don't really apply here, because even Jasmine admitted to killing her brother while Jeremy killed the two parents. So it's definitely a different type of crime. Even though it's a familicide, there was two offenders. which is very different in the psychology, but she had even said multiple times that she doesn't like kids, she doesn't like small kids, she would get so annoyed with Jacob. So it was really kind of tough to read, like, when she had killed Jacob. And her motive for that was she didn't want Jacob to go into foster care. She didn't want him to be hurt. She didn't want him to live through the trauma. He would be better off dead.
Oh, okay. Makes sense.
I also find this case, as you mentioned earlier, similar to Gypsy Rose, where I think that there was manipulation on both ends. While Jasmine's parents were nowhere near as abusive and they were just looking out for her best interests, they seemed like great parents. Of course, we don't know what happens behind closed doors, but if you have a 12-year-old that's dating a 16-year-old, then a 23-year-old, and has older male friends that are 19, 20, and 21, like, you're going to punish them. They didn't hit her. They didn't, like, starve her. They just did the best punishment that they thought they could do.
Right.
So, Jasmine believed that she was being too controlled and she couldn't live to be herself. So she begged and pleaded Jeremy to kill her family so they could be together. Jeremy eventually did it when he believed it would solidify his love for her. I also want to mention that there were many parts of the story that was a first for Medicine Hat, but when Jasmine was being interrogated, an officer had told her that he would deliver a note to Jeremy in order to gain her trust. And they would eventually write love notes to each other. And this was never heard of for inmates to be communicating. But in this type of situation where it's just this, like, forbidden love and these two awkward people, you know, that were really into communicating each other and were writing each other songs and poetry, that the officer thought it would be a good bargaining tool. Like, if you tell me information, I'll bring more notes. And that caused a lot of criticism. That officer then gained even more criticism because there were a few questions about the interrogation, because in order to build the rapport, he followed the Reed technique. And part of the Reed technique is that he would stroke her hair, he would put his hand on her shoulder, he would stand very close to her, and a lot of people were like, this is a 12-year-old girl. This is, like, very inappropriate.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
The Reed technique is super interesting, but it's also super controversial. Since we're all about education on this podcast, I'm going to teach you guys about it really quick. So it's obviously a lot more complex than what I'm about to say, but in a nutshell, there's 9 steps to it. So the first step is direct confrontation. This is where the officers say they have evidence proving the suspect's guilt, even if they don't. If you guys watch any interrogations, you'll see this all the time. They'll say, oh, we already know you did it. We already have your DNA. They're just trying to get them to admit it. The second step is trying to shift the blame from the suspect to someone else or to justify the crime in some way. So in this case, maybe they would tell Jasmine, oh, we know Jeremy forced you. It's okay. You can tell us. It's not really your fault.
Mm-hmm.
The third step would be to minimize the amount of times the suspect denies their involvement. The fourth step is when a suspect gives a reason about why they couldn't or didn't commit the crime, you basically flip this and use it against them to try and get them to admit that they did do it. The fifth step is to reinforce sincerity, be the good cop. So this is just like you said, stroking their hair, putting an arm around them. You see a lot, they'll offer coffee or cigarettes. The sixth step is when the suspect becomes quiet or cries, you essentially use this to infer their guilt. The seventh step is to give the suspect 2 choices about what happened, both of which will be them admitting to their guilt, but one of the choices will be less bad or more socially acceptable than the other. So for Jasmine, you know, maybe these options would be, again, like, oh, Jeremy forced her, she didn't really have a say, or the other choice is that she murdered her family in cold blood. Mm-hmm. Either way, whichever one she said, she's admitting that she, you know, played a hand in the murders. The eighth step is getting the suspect to repeat their confession in front of witnesses. And the ninth step is just documenting the confession. We can definitely discuss interrogation techniques in a different episode as well. I could talk about this forever.
Yeah, I find interrogation techniques so interesting. And I mean, both of them really sing like a canary. It took a while because at first Jasmine was telling half-truths and the officer was like, okay, Jasmine, like, I believe you, but I need you to tell me the whole truth. Like, there's no half-truths here. Like, that's only a half-truth. as opposed to saying that that's a lie, because if, you know, using, because those two words have different connotations.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, they do get charged, and in the aftermath, they were still, like, writing each other love notes in prison, talking about how they could finally be together. They got engaged while they were in prison. And a lot of people were concerned because Jasmine just did not seem to comprehend what she was doing. They just thought that she was just a cold-blooded murderer. She did not care. She had no empathy. She had no remorse. Mm-hmm. And then around 16, 17, she really started to, like, come out of herself. And she's like, oh, my God, I did that. I did what's happening. So it wasn't until 16 that it was hitting her what had happened. There wasn't too much about Jeremy, about his role in prison. But we do know that Jasmine eventually was let out in 2016. And then in 2020, so 2 years ago, she had her record expunged. She does have a different name. She got a high school degree and a college degree while she was in prison. So she lives a relatively normal life now. But it's so hard because you want to say that there's grooming because it's like the steps are there. But it's also so hard because I really just, Jeremy's mental state makes it so hard to call it that, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
This wasn't an all there 30-year-old man who's hitting on a 14-year-old girl, because, like, it's so much different. And it happened on both sides. Like, she was also love-bombing him when, you know, she didn't really know any better. She was looking for a way out. This is just such a difficult, difficult case because it involves such a young juvenile and an older male who mentally may not be as old as his birth certificate shows. And while it's so hard to imagine a 12-year-old being manipulative, especially with an older male in the picture, there's definitely a form of manipulation on both sides.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that makes it really difficult and very hard to swallow. And again, I'm not apologizing for anything that they did. Obviously, the relationship between Jeremy and Jasmine was completely disgusting and completely disregarded. Obviously, the relationship between Jasmine and Jeremy is completely disgusting. And that alone should just be an entire case. But that concludes this episode of Dr. Crime.
For more information, check the podcast description where we link the sources to all of our information. Also, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Dr. Crime Pod. Oh, and Twitter now. And leave us a review wherever you stream your podcast. Thank you all for listening, and we can't wait to talk to you next.